Only because I've been asked by the chief executive to move it very quick. Wait and see who's coming in. Hello, Mark. That's it. We're all full contingent. Right. Give him a chance to sit down. Okay, got your breath back? Okay. Right, make a start then. For a start off, I've had apologies from John Holmes, and Michelle is covering for him, and Karen has also sent a substitute of the chief executive. Right.
And there's also Councillor Perks' apologies, Chairman.
Councillor Perks has also sent an apology. All right, we'll turn to the agenda then. The minutes of the 7th of September are on the council webpage. We move to item 2, apologies, and I've mentioned officers' apologies.
And Councillor Perks.
Right, public question time.
That's nil.
Councillor session.
That's nil.
Members' item.
That's nil.
And called in item.
And there are none.
We turn then to 7A, which is page 3. Right. Would you like to come to the table? Michelle, are you joining as well? Right. Okay. Okay, you're gonna lead on this, Michelle.
I am, but deferring to my chief executive first of all.
Okay, so it's up to you then. So this is the report then, starts on page 3.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. And apologies from Karen and Deborah. I know both wanted to be here to talk about this issue. We had some discussion at it at the last meeting, and I undertook to bring back to you just to explain where we're up to. If I give a very swift overview, and then Michelle has some comments, and of course Councillor BT. Having discussed this at some length with Karen and John in preparation of the report, I think what I want to say to you that you would have gathered from the report is that we faced, like many other authorities up and down the country, a bit of a perfect storm from the pandemic, which has impacted on the delivery of this service. So for 18 months, many of our local residents were sat in their home, wishing it was a bit bigger and there was a bit more distance between them and other family members, many of them working from home. And that's resulted in a very significant increase in the number of planning applications that we have had, and an increase in particular in smaller applications from individual households looking for extensions of conservatories and other means of increasing their space within their home. And one of the results of that is that they have very often completed the application forms themselves without any great experience in having done so, rather than getting an architect or an agent or somebody else with great experience to do it. And that has caused us a great deal of difficulty in terms of trying to validate the applications, because they're very often being filled in incorrectly with incomplete information that's not allowed us to complete the validation. And we've always had a culture in this authority of seeking to assist applicants with being able to put in their applications, and therefore it's taken quite a lot of work from colleagues within the planning department assisting people to try to get their applications in. And on occasions we've had applications that have come in and had to go back and forth several times to gain the necessary information to have them. There's not always individual applicants, household or applicants, that have that problem. Sometimes you'd be surprised at the number of some of the people who've got more experience than you'd expect them to be able to do this appropriately to do it. So we've had some delays, particularly at the validation stage early on, and that has built up. And Michelle will talk to you about what we've done to address that in terms of the additional resources that we've brought in. We've also had the planning officers and the validation officers through much of this period working from home. We will remember we all decamped very quickly at the beginning of the first lockdown to working from home. Quite difficult for planning officers to do that, and different to people like myself who really only need a laptop and a comfy chair to do our work. They need access to plans and records and to consult with each other and indeed other professionals, be they highways or to do with trees or the environment agency and so forth. And again, that's had an impact in terms of the performance. And actually, they've worked extraordinarily hard to try to keep up to speed as far as they've been able to, despite those issues. And as soon as we were able to, we've been able to encourage staff to come into this building and work together. And we did that at a point where we had to very clearly social distance them, where they had to wear masks, where we had to have the windows open. And so more recently, we've been able to bring more of them in. We've also sought to recruit to those posts within the planning team that were vacant. And that was obviously proved quite difficult during a period of lockdown as well. We've had some success in doing that. But there is a shortage of qualified and experienced planning officers up and down the country. And some of you may have seen some of the reports considered by our neighbouring authorities who've had the same issues that we've had in terms of pressure on the service and who have restructured their planning teams and put out quite sizable adverts recently with new posts and improved offers to try to attract people to come in. So Michelle will be able to tell you in more detail about whom we've been able to recruit. But it's not been simply a matter of saying, well, we've had a 30% increase in the volume of activity, therefore a huge increase in demand on the service, so we'll bring in extra people. We've just not been able to get hold of those in that same volume. So we've taken quite a number of measures, which are set out in the report, to improve the situation. We are now getting some improvement and a little bit of reduction in the pace of applications coming, which has helped us. And I think this is critical to us, because we only want to fulfil the aspirations of our local residents. Secondly, we're very mindful that we want to be able to build houses and we want to be able to support businesses establishing and setting up and expanding within the borough. And that's why the planning team is in the development and economic development in the same development team. So we've been frustrated along with this. We've done the things that we believed that we could do and we've made some progress, but there is still some way to go before we get back to where we were pre-pandemic. Michelle, please correct any of that that I got wrong and add to it the bits that I've left out.
No, that was all right. So there are a few bits that John just asked me to draw your attention to before we go through. I think we'll probably go through the paper page by page anyway, so I can just highlight
all
a
right.
few bits and pieces for you. So the first thing is, in terms of planning application performance, we have a system that's been in place it's a number of years now, maybe 6 or 7 years, where we report nationally on our planning application performance, where that's split into major applications and basically everything else. It's basically where the league tables come from, so you'll hear every so often who's at the top of the league table, who's at the bottom, and that's the table that's used to determine which are the best performing authorities. That data is collected over a rolling 2-year period, so at the end of a quarter we then have to count back 2 years worth. So when we report those figures, I think one of the members has mentioned previously, performance figures look fantastic, but you're telling us that you're struggling at the minute, and it's basically because those figures go over such a long period of time. When you then have those huge amounts of applications all added together, it takes longer for the impact of particularly COVID to show through in the figures. So what John's done in the report is update you on where we are on that national figure, that national league table expectation that we have to report on, but also where we are currently, so that the most recent, I think it actually goes to the end of October in the report, snapshot of where we're up to, so that you get a feel for what's actually going on the ground. Because that then matches probably what you're hearing from people who are experiencing the planning system at the minute. So a couple of bits that you did want me to highlight. In terms of the oldest application, so Tim was talking about validation of applications. So there's a bit of a misconception that if you put a planning application in, we basically data input it into the system, then it goes on its merry way. Anyone that sits on the planning committee will know that we have local validation criteria that basically sets out what is quite a long list of requirements per application type for the types of information that you need to provide as part of the planning application. they are complicated and they must also be consistent. So, for example, if I'm going to do an extension on my house, I'll have to do plans that I'm not a planner, so excuse the terms. I'll do flat plans and I'll do stand-up plans, and you've got to make sure that the flat plans match the stand-up plans. And if you then start tinkering with one plan, it throws the other one out. And those are the kinds of things that our validation team have to sit down and compare, sometimes 10, 15 plans, to make sure they all match. Because if they don't, that gets us in trouble later if we approve something and the plans don't match. And someone says, that's built wrong. Well, is it? Is it that plan or that plan? So that's why validation takes a long time. So at the beginning of October, we were nudging a 12-week backlog on validation. As at yesterday, it's 9 weeks, so our oldest outstanding application at the moment is the 6th of September. That's a huge move forward, because when you have a backlog with validation, it essentially feeds itself, because everybody that's waiting to hear from us then chases to say, what's happening with my application, which means you spend less time dealing with the backlog, because you're trying to manage that person's expectations. So that time's coming down. One of the things we did there was bring in someone that used to work for the authority in a slightly different role, but he was familiar with us, he was familiar with our IT systems, and he's been trained specifically to focus on the householder applications. So we didn't have to spend too long putting training in for him, so that the more experienced members of the team could concentrate on the really difficult stuff. So that balance is starting to pay off. We've also had a colleague from elsewhere in the authority do that initial bit of data input, so that extra resource there is really paying off. If we can now start to see a drop off in the new applications coming in at the same time as we're chipping through that backlog, that's when we'll see that shift start to happen. So that's validation. Then in terms of staffing, again, if you can remember back before the pandemic, we had an issue in recruiting planning officers then. There was a shortage of them. And the problem is that it's very, very competitive with the private sector. So you can go work for a planning consultancy, the people that then put in the planning applications. So you can kind of work on both sides of the fence as a planner. So it's very, very competitive. Something we've had in place in planning for 9 years is a grow your own ethos. So we have a number of people that come in, either graduates or people that just left school, and we train them up. And that means literally teaching them planning from the ground up. And a number of them are going to university, but that takes time. And where we struggle is at the senior planning officer level. We have managed to recruit one full-time person from a neighbouring authority who, again, those of you on the planning committee will have met her. She was at the planning committee last week. But we are reliant on agency staff at the minute. So there are two full-time agency planners that are basically supporting the team. It's not a situation unique to Stafford. Every local planning authority is having the same issues. And it's not just an issue for planning. We find the same with environmental health, with HR, with finance. It's just that friction between the public and private sector. It's a very competitive market. You will notice, though, that there is a budget overspend, and that is purely because agency staff are expensive. But it's not something we can do without at the moment. And then finally, he asked me to draw your attention to enforcement, because I know that's been a particularly difficult issue just because of the nature of the work that involves. So we have two new staff. Most of you will know one of them, used to work in our housing options team. He's moved across to the planning enforcement team. We've also recruited someone in. And then we have a third agency person who is at a more senior level. So we've got these two brand new enforcement officers who are doing a sterling job. Basically putting the customer first, ringing them up, saying, I'm really sorry, you might have been waiting a while, we're on it. Whilst we've got the experienced person basically looking at more difficult cases to make sure that everything's started moving again. So the outstanding cases for enforcement are also coming down. That should make your job easier, because that issue of people saying, why haven't I heard anything, that starts to ease off. But again, that's where we've got the agency resource. Those are the things that John particularly wanted me to draw to your attention, but I'm happy to take any questions as you go through.
Okay then. Right. Page by page then. I've already got somebody. Page 3. Are you on page 3, Jenny?
No. This is related to something else, though, which I'd like to ask.
Yeah, all right, well, go on then. Let's do that first. All right, Jenny's got a question first. I'll see you, Chris.
Thank you. On the 6th of October, in the Stafford newsletter, there is an article of South Staff's proposal. proposed development, which borders on the edge of Wildwood. We thought this last time when Gladman wanted to build, I'm sure you're aware of that. I just wanted to know if you are aware of it and if you will be able to, the planning department will be able to reply and deal with this issue on behalf of the borough. Obviously, it's going to affect the infrastructure greatly, and it is really a very large development.
You want to? Are you going to do, Francis?
It's like Yenel's department. I have actually signed a letter back to South Staffs as of yesterday. They have asked for consultation. We've also got a meeting set up with them, I think, next week to go through the whole of their plan and obviously the section that borders, your ward is going to be extremely important.
Yes.
In those deliberations, particularly in mind of the previous Gladstone case that we caught on.
As far as I know, nobody's had any consultation letters regarding this at all. It's close by. All those people have seen is this article in the newsletter. So obviously we're going to get bombarded in a short while about it.
Yes, it did. Michelle's just explaining really that this isn't a planning application. This is to do with the local plan. It's the site application under the local plan. It's not. It's nothing to do with the planning application. But obviously, the developers would like the site earmarked, and we would prefer that it wasn't.
Yes.
And that's quite clear because I think we made that clear in our initial response. I would suggest that you probably ask to be put on the circulation list by South Staff so to ensure that you get information about the whole of the progress of, this, of the local plan, just as you are being consulted on.
Thank you. And if you could keep us informed as well.
And I'll look on Skellix to make sure that you're going to get to update
it. Now, I've got three people who want to indicate they want to speak. Is it anything to do with what Councillor Barron has mentioned?
No.
Mark says it is.
No.
No. All right.
I think as Ray are the members for highly possible and obviously that's going to be impacting the area you're talking about. I'm really concerned that a neighbouring authority can basically on Stafford Borough, which has had two or three big applications coming in that end of town. The infrastructure is creeping, and I think it's pretty abysmal of South Staff to do this. And I'm sure Francis will do her very best to highlight this fact. It's the same with the 106 one. If anything did happen there, where would they go? 106 months, would they go down to Kimber or somewhere? I think we really have to sort of jump on this straight away rather than sort of sit there and wait for the consultation which occasionally is really bearing fruits, but it does impact on all of us on that side of Stafford.
Right. Now are you coming back on that particular point?
Yeah,
all right.
Okay, so there's basically two bits to it. So like Francis said, there's the consultation.
Can you shout a bit because Jenny's at this end?
Sorry, I'm usually told I'm too loud. So basically there's two bits to it. So there's the local plan bit where they basically say in broad terms, this is where we want housing, this is where we want employment, and there's a consultation process that happens as part of that. And that's what Alex leans on from the borough's point of view. When you get to planning application stage, and we've had to do this recently, when you have an actual planning application that is on the border of two districts, there's a requirement to consult us as neighbouring local planning authority. So we do get involved as part of that. You'll see that come up on the weekly lists that Vicky and Ellie from my team send out, so you'll be able to see those applications coming in. As far as Section 106 money goes, we've actually had this with an application about 5 or 6 years ago, which was on the border with the Cannock District, where basically the houses were built right on the edge of Stafford Borough, and there was an open space contribution that related. it wasn't reasonable for Stafford to claim that Section 106 contribution because the open space was required within Cannock District. So you can have those negotiations where that sits outside of that district. So I think as part of that application process, and there is Section 106 considerations, that's what would form part of our representation when we reply back. And that can be as the neighbouring local planning authority and as individuals if you want to comment on those applications.
Okay. All right, Jenny?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Now, I'm going to call page numbers. I'll write you down. Mark, excuse me a minute. Mark, was that the only thing you wanted to talk about?
I want to talk, but it's...
Okay, as we go then. Okay, I've got down, you're about the fourth one down, Marnie. Okay, I've got... I'm going through the pages, all right? I've done page three. Okay.
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to thank Tim and Michelle and John through Michelle, and hope we get better soon, for the report. I am a bit concerned that a lot of it was concentrating on validation. I actually mentioned at the last meeting an application that I was dealing with, and I spoke to Tim about it afterwards. And that being validated in late 2020, it still hasn't been decided. I am just a bit, I understand the problems, because I know that other authorities have got the same, I know my son works for the authority of North, they've got the same in all aspects, across the board in all departments. So I do understand that, but that seems an awful lot of time, Jen. And this is what, it's five times validations mentioned, and throughout the report from the officers, it was mentioned time and time again. And I think we need to get past that validation stage and start looking at why certain applications haven't actually, once they've been validated, why they haven't gone through the system.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's make a point that we will not discuss individual cases.
Yeah.
This is a general thing, but you answer that particular question, but
yeah.
I suggest that Councillor Barron, Chris,
yeah,
gives you the information and then you communicate to her.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
So basically, the issue around validation has taken such centre stage because that's been probably the first thing that people experience. So they hit the planning system and then they think straight away their name is going to get a letter and they're not getting it. And I think because validation pre-COVID was something we turned around in three days to 5 days, no one really knew it went on. So that's why we've explained that. It's also easier to give you a picture of what's going on there because that's a process, whereas what you're asking about, quite rightly, that is an individual application. Now, what I can assure you of is that the management team in development management meet once a week and they basically look at every single application that's on the books. Why aren't they moving? And there'll be various reasons. It could be that an applicant's been asked to amend their plans because otherwise they'll get a refusal. It might be that a statutory consultee has objected and we're trying to find a way of working around that. It could be that we're in the middle of a negotiation on a Section 106 agreement. There's all sorts of reasons why they can get stuck. If something was validated at the end of 2020, we don't want it on the books because all that's doing is generating why we might have a decision. So I don't want anyone to feel as if something's old, it's just sat there and nothing's being done with it. There will be an issue with it. That's why they're still there. But by all means, if anyone's got any individual cases that they want us to have a look at where that blockage is, that's absolutely fine. We'll pick those up. But the actual individual monitoring of the caseloads happens between the team leaders. So Sean and Richard manage the teams individually, and then collectively all the managers sit down and look at where are the applications, how are they moving, which ones are going to committee, which ones need a legal agreement. So that individual case management is there.
Okay.
Jim, can I just remind members to put any inquiries or whatever else through Vicky? Don't at this stage. The new system, which is where everything's being channeled, is actually working extremely well, and I think members would agree. So can we make that work and continue that?
Okay.
Right. Okay. Now that dealt with Chris on the and I open things, and Jenny. So now I'm going to turn to Gareth. I'm going to call for page 4.
This is where it's at. I would want you to talk to the whole report.
Okay, fair enough. You're on the whole report then.
And I think I have pressed
D as well.
Yeah, D as well.
Welcome the report. I pressed for a report at the last meeting, and I'm pleased that we've got it. I think that one thing I'm not picking up out of this is where we actually stand in relation to establishment. And I know that you've got to take agency staff into consideration when you're making comparisons with the establishment, but I haven't got a feel for how many vacancies, where the senior vacancies exist. And I found it, it's a problem, but I think if you go to page 21, and it talks there about development management reduced income, 158,000, that seems to me to be quite a large figure, and I'm just wondering if that, what I found it difficult was to relate that figure to this report. And that seems to me to be an overspend. And is that overspend because of the amount of volume? And are we charging enough for applications, etc.? I found it difficult to reconcile those two situations.
Yeah.
One that shows that we're working like mad below establishment.
Mm.
And the other is that we've got a major overspend. I don't know how much 158,000 is in relation to the department's budget, but it seems to me to be quite a significant sum.
Right.
So if I start with the number of staff first of all, so we aren't currently carrying any vacancies because they're all backfilled with the agency staff.
So you're up to establishment.
We're up to establishment, but a piece of work that Tim's asked John to look at now is on the basis that the increased new applications that have been coming in haven't tailed off as we'd expected. So we knew we were going to get lots and lots of householder applications because people were sat at home, they couldn't move house, they'd want a home office, all that kind of stuff. We knew we were going to get people from that. It hasn't dropped off particularly. It's come down a little bit, but not loads. So John's now reviewing, on the assumption that the number of incoming applications remains static, do we now have enough staff to manage that? So going forward, he's doing that piece of work. So in terms of bums on seats for now, we're not carrying any vacancies because they're covered by the agency staff, but the agency staff are expensive by virtue of that's what they do. In terms of the income, all of the fees are set by government. So, for example, a householder application, I'm going to get shouted at by my team because I can't remember the exact amount, it's about £300 for an application that can have more work involved in it than a major application for a warehouse shed, which we might get several thousand pounds for. So you can't relate the income to the complexity of the work because you could have a fantastically contentious small application and a larger application with big fee that nobody is interested in. So it's quite difficult to correlate the two. The other thing to say is we can have one or two major applications that have significant fee income on them that completely skew the figure of the income coming in. So I don't try and match the income to the workload because it's not an exact enough science.
Can I ask Chairman?
Yeah, go on.
Are you thinking about seeking an increase in the establishment to be able to get more in balance with the input of workload?
Chair, if I may, as Michelle's indicated, I've asked John to do that piece of work to tell us what resources we would need to cope with an increased workload of the sort that we've seen to date so that we can make sure that we are able to transact the business that we're required to. That's always assuming that we can recruit somebody, because as Michelle has described that as difficult. And as Michelle has said, we may have had an increase of almost 30% in terms of the volume of applications, but that hasn't resulted in a commensurate increase in the fee income that came with it.
Well, that's a major issue for the council, isn't it, really? Because I think that for what you're saying, by hook or by crook, either by recruiting or by contracting with agencies, that you will attempt to increase the capacity of the department to match the input. But it's a worry that having done that, you're likely to cause financial strain within the organisation. And I think that that needs to be. I haven't got a clue how you don't deal with that, but I think it's a major issue that needs attention.
Just a minute. What do you say, Andy?
I'm just saying, thinking that if you can't get staff, you're still back at stage one, aren't you? You can't get staff to get the backlog down. No matter what you're offering, we're going to be in the same position. Even worse, it's going to get worse instead of better.
Well, you will get staff, but it will be at a price.
You can't get the staff.
Right, okay. So, anything else, Gareth?
Well, can I just... I mentioned this figure of 158,000. What is it?
Chairman,
in relation to this report,
I could answer that. It's a smoke and mirrors with the finance department.
Pardon?
It's to do with setting budgets that I've struggled to find the answer to this. And Michelle's just told me don't even go there. But it is actually. It is an issue that I've been raising for 2 or 3 years now. It doesn't seem to me to be a real figure.
Well, it's in the report.
Chair, to answer it in a slightly different way, it is, as Michelle indicated, the balance between the number of major applications that we have which command a higher fee income versus the number of smaller applications we have which can result in just as much work but actually have a much smaller income because, as Michelle said, the fees are set by central government, so we don't have any control over that. And as Councillor Beattie says, what we've got here is a projection, and the market at the moment is sufficiently volatile that we need to just be a little cautious about accepting that. I think we want to update as we go on through the year.
All right, okay.
Well, how is it okay? I don't understand it, but still.
Yeah. No, I mean, are you finished asking the questions?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to move to Mark. I've got about four names down here. So Mark was next.
Yeah, I'll be as swift as I can, Chair. Two issues for me, really. And one, I'm afraid, is one for the Chief Exec. And that's... Everyone's mentioned working from home. As we are starting to move, hopefully, to a more relaxed situation around COVID, what are the plans going forward? Because it's not just the Stafford Borough, it's also Stafford County. The buildings are somewhat similar to sort of... Yeah, they're empty. There's no one there. So that's a question for the Chief Exec. And then moving on, I do see the importance of validation to the whole process. If you've got validation, planning applications coming in, whether large or small, that were easily dealt with, and then lined up with the process we've got at the borough, that would then mean the whole process will become slicker and the cogs would start to move in that way. And it's just, has anyone thought of speaking to either within the public sector or the private sector, giving people the opportunity to go to a body or a person or a firm that can actually set out the validation, the planning application. So when it comes to Stafford Borough, it helps us as well. And I see what you say about national charges, but there must be a way of fast-tracking some of these applications.
So if I deal with the question addressed to me, if I restrict myself to the matters covered in this report, so not talk more broadly about the council as a whole.
Well, it's economic development and planning scrutiny.
Yes, but the report is about the performance of the Development Control Department. So we have encouraged John and his colleagues to return to the building in a way that is COVID safe. I think we have to be very mindful of our responsibilities as an employer to their health and safety, and therefore we've made sure that the conditions are such that we can do effective social distancing and all of the other measures that you would expect in their place, and they've responded very positively by spending quite a bit of their working time each week in the building. And that's helpful because it improves the communication between colleagues, it provides them access to all of the plants and so forth that I mentioned before. However, the overall COVID figures are still not what we would hope. They've gone in the wrong direction, and I think it's very difficult to compel people to come and work here shared office space in those circumstances. And I think we have a discussion about the wider issue relating to the rest of the council on another occasion, if I may suggest.
Right. Okay, Mark.
No, the second question.
Second question again.
Okay, so I would love it if we could triage at validation stage. And if I compare it to what the rest of the support team do, where they manage the generic inbox where all the emails come in for planning, they can skim quickly through those and pick out the urgent things, pick out the councillor call-ins, pick out the appeals, and that moves that quickly. It's absolutely impossible to do so with validation because you have to do a full validation to understand whether there's information missing. And if we go back, so 10 years ago, where there was a swifter approach to validation, you miss out a report or there's a plan missing, and then we start the process and we start consulting people, we can't stop the performance clock to get that back survey. And it might be 7 months before we can get that back survey. So we have to make sure we've got absolutely everything during validation. And I wish it was a tick box exercise because it would make dealing with the backlog so much easier, but it's just not possible. The level of detail we're talking about is, I've got 5 sets of plans here. Are they all measuring to the same scale? And when they measure, can I compare this one to that one? And is the existing and the proposed matching what the proposal on the application form is telling me? That's hours of work. I wish it wasn't because that's the thing that takes the time. We've used external people before, probably about 8 years ago. It didn't work. It created a bigger problem because it's our local validation criteria. It's our processes. It's our customers. It's our systems. You put more energy into trying to make that work. You almost create an industry out of supporting the support function, streamlining what we've done. So we've brought in people that are taking away different bits of the process. So I mentioned the person that just looks at householders. That's the best way of tackling this. And given that we've pulled back, what was it, 3 weeks through October, that shows it's working. It just needs a little bit more time.
Right, fair enough. Okay. All right, Marnie, is yours a general question or is it on the pages?
I've got a question for page 5.
Okay, well I'm going to call 4. Now I've got 3 other names down. I've got D, Phil and Andy. Alright, so anybody want to ask questions on page 4?
Yeah.
Okay, well I'll take D first and follow up by Phil.
I mean it's partly on the back of what Gareth said, but also, and taking into account what you said about the difficulty of recruitment, and I think the term you used was bums on seat. So what is your bums on seat number and what was it, say, compared to, say, 10 years ago?
Okay, so it's quite difficult because the structure of the team has changed. So I started working in the planning team in 2010, and basically you had a big team of planners of varying abilities, but they basically all came in and they got a planning degree. They might have had some experience. And what we found is that there's a big tranche of work where you can actually use that work to train people in-house to get to the level of senior planner. So what we have is basically different levels of experience. So if I start from the lowest level, so that is people that come to us with absolutely no experience, so that's planning assistant. So we created a post that is planning assistant, and when they've got some experience, they become, let me get this right, assistant planner. And when they've got some more experience and we've put them through a university course, they become planning officer. And what we've done is made those posts so that someone can come in at any one of those 3 levels and work their way up. So we have, I think, 3 people that fit those posts. We then have senior planning officers. So these are the people that have seen it all, done it all. They've got their RTPI accreditation. They will sit in a public inquiry when we've got an appeal. And we have, I think it's either three or four of those. It's at that level we really struggle, because those are the experienced people that have seen all the different types of applications, so everyone wants them. We've then got a hybrid post, which is part planning officer, part conservation officer. So for any of you that remember our previous conservation officers, they left, we couldn't recruit. So we've trained somebody that we were training up through the planning ranks. We then sent her on a university course. She's just qualified with a distinction. She's now a qualified conservation officer. So she's undertaking that role. We've then got three development lead level posts that basically manage all that workload. But also when we get there are really big applications like things like Burley Fields, they will take on some of that because they're so big, they serve as a distraction to people with caseloads of lots of applications. So that's how it works. So numbers wise, it's probably roughly comparable, but the stretch of skills is better. And then to pick up on a point someone made earlier, what are we going to do in a few years' time? Well, in a few years' time, we've got five trainees that will be fully qualified. So we'll then be bringing through the next tranche of trainees so that we've got that constant supply, if you like, of new planners.
Right. Okay. I've got Phil on the same page.
Yep. 5.5, the council is scheduled to maintain a full complement of case officers. Does this indicate that we're not keeping the staff? And if so, what steps have been taken to investigate why people are leaving? Is it salaries, working environment, workload, lack of promotion opportunities? And do you conduct exit interviews when people leave?
Okay, so in terms of longevity of posts, so if I start at the senior level, so our development leads, I think one's been with us 21 years, the other one's about 16 years, something like that, so they have been here a long time, they've worked their way up, they've got their promotion. Most of those people within the team I just mentioned have been promoted at least once, some of them three or four times, so it's definitely progression. That's why we restructured back in 2012. The reasons we've had the vacancies most recently, they're generally family reasons. So people who have maybe moved into this area to go to university have tried to settle here and then thought, actually, I want to go home. It's too far. So we lost a couple of really good trainee planners that way. We also had a chap that moved to us and his family circumstances just changed. And he wanted to move to work for an agency because it gave him flexibility that fitted his lifestyle. I think the fact that when we have recruited, we've managed to draw people in from neighbouring authorities means that we've got something to offer. So because of, ironically, the level of planning applications that we deal with, because of the interest of development in the borough, for a planner, we offer a really interesting caseload. They can get, they can cut their teeth on some really interesting work. But yeah, to answer the final bit of your question, yes, exit interviews are carried out, but we aren't concerned with any of the reasons why people have left us, because they've been for sort of genuine. It's nothing to do with staff at Borough. That's not why they're leaving.
Right, fair enough then. Okay, yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, we're moving then on to page five. So it's Marnie.
Can I just move on something on validation?
In a moment, we've got you after Marnie now.
Sorry, Marnie. Carry on.
Right, Marnie.
Thank you. I was a little bit dismayed to see under 5.13 that, obviously we know that staff are under an immense amount of pressure, but it does say in here that you're pointing out that the staff should be respected and shouting at them or being abusive would not give them a quicker service. I feel quite... I'm really dismayed at this, if I'm honest. I think to find out that the officers and staff are getting abuse on the telephone, I think is absolutely appalling. There were a couple of things that I wanted to ask. Do the staff find that because of the greater pressure that they're under at the moment, that through COVID and with there being no face-to-face contact, do they find that the abuse is worse now as a result, and if so, how is this affecting the officers and the staff, and do we have anything in place to support them?
Okay. So if I start probably somewhere in the middle of that, if that's okay. So in terms of no face-to-face contact, no, there isn't any face-to-face contact with customers, but to be honest, there wasn't a huge amount of that pre-COVID anyway. The majority of the planning process, you know, agents put applications in through the planning portal. It's all dealt with electronically, and we'd speak to them on the phone, but it's very rare an agent would need to actually come in. We were quite digital before we needed to be digital in that respect. I think the difference is, when you've got an office full of people, if you've got somebody on the phone that is probably completely justified, feeling stressed and a bit cross, and has shouted at you, when you put the phone down, you turn around, and there's a bank of people, and, oh, that was a tough call. And I think you lose that a little bit, but as Tim mentioned earlier, that's one of the reasons why we've been encouraging the staff to come back into the office, so that they have got that support from each other. In terms of more formal support, yes, there's lots of different things available, either by the team talking to their individual line managers or through HR. There's a whole package of stuff available, so that, and they are made aware of that. I think it's probably just the frequency, and it's a thing that you get when you're in a backlog, because people will be cross if they've been waiting for something, but instead of having maybe one cross person a week, you might have a couple each day, and I think that's just where it gets a little bit difficult to deal with, which is why that reference is in the report, just to say, stop and think, because it's a human on the other end of the phone. So yeah, it's something that's happening. We've got the support mechanisms in place, but it would be really nice if it wasn't happening in the first place.
I am really dismayed to see that written in the report. Because
you have to speak up on that last bit.
I said I'm really dismayed to see that in the report, because we know if it has to be reported in this way, that it's a problem, and it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. You know, in this era of being kind to each other, this is not something we should expect to see written down at all. So, you know, pass on our thanks to the staff members, and you know, and my regards, and just my dismay at the fact that I'm seeing this written down. Thank you.
Right, Andy.
Regarding this validation, I mean, the things have to be validated so it can be built properly. But when you get properties, like there's one very close to me, which had an application to renovate and then completely demolished a building outside in the countryside, I even had to find the telephone number for our panels, and it's on the gate. They didn't even go near the gate to find it. It's been completely demolished, rebuilt, much bigger. A barn on the side of it has been incorporated into the house. Nobody, I've heard no information whatsoever from our panels regarding this matter. Now, this isn't just one building that's been built without planning. There's a number of them. One was a builder who had planning refused and has still built what he wanted, and nobody's done a thing about it, as yet, to my knowledge. But I just wonder how many more of these things are going on.
So I can't answer how many, because that's a bit like saying how many undiscovered caves are there. We only know what we're told about. So if a report has been made, then an enforcement case will have been opened. Without knowing the site, and I can't get into site specifics, I don't know what the process is, but effectively, we're talking about three different processes here. So validation is getting the applications ready for assessment. Then you've got the assessment process that leads to a decision, and that might be by a committee, it might not, and you'll get an approval or you'll get a refusal. And then you've got the what happens after. And the what happens after, we are no planning authority in the country is resourced to go and monitor every single development that happens. So we rely on reports coming to us to say, did you know that this person had permission for this, but they've done that, or they've built it wrong, or whatever. And we will then investigate that. And we know there have been delays with dealing with enforcement complaints for all the reasons we've set out, and we've got that team resourced. But I can't go into the specifics of the case. I'll pick it up outside of the meeting.
Yeah,
but we can't. We can't legislate for what people do after they've got that permission.
They can build if they want to, but it's surrounded by properties, and you know, just everybody's up in arms about it, that somebody can demolish a complete building and build just what he wanted. And he works all weekend banging and knocking, and there's some elderly residents around there that are absolutely fed up of it, and nothing's been done whatsoever. And as I say, it's been going on for 6 months now. But that's that's another issue. But there's so many issues that are, I think, very important that they should be looked at.
If you can tell me what they are, I'll let you know what the issues
all right,
are.
I'll give you a minute.
That's the important point, is that you report it in.
Yeah, I have reported it in.
I got Brian Cross one for his hand up.
No, I was pointing to the
D
indicator.
Yeah,
on page number 5, and you've got 5.10, you talk about, in the last paragraph, the threshold under which councils would be designated measures in currently 60% and 70%. So what were the thresholds in the past? Were they different?
No, they've always been 60% and 70%, and we've been way above them for a long, long time. We were very close to them at one point on major applications, which is when we looked at shuffling around the way we dealt with the work. We are way, way above them. I think only a couple of councils have ever actually been designated, and what that means is the local planning authority lose the right to make determinations on an application. So an applicant can say, oh, I'd rather the planning inspectorate determine this. In practice, it doesn't happen very often. But obviously, we don't want to be down there. We don't want to have that kind of reputation because it puts developers off. But no, they've been set like that. I think it's about 2013, 14, something like that. And they haven't moved for a while.
Right. That it? On page 5?
Jim, can I just add on that? Those figures show how well our service is performing. And yes, we have problems that we've discussed this evening and before, but my goodness, that is a pretty good record of performance, and that's government figures. We haven't fixed those. The government has set those.
Right.
We're well up the table of performing.
There is a question that I'm going to ask, and it really is something that Andy was pointing out. But that very last sentence on 5.13, we also point out that our staff should be respecting and shouting at them and being abusive and not give any quicker service. Who is that aimed at? Who is that sentence aimed at? Is it aimed at the general public?
Applicants, Jim.
Sorry?
Principally applicants, Jim.
Applicants. So that's fair enough then.
Chair, it shouldn't
be, is it aimed at officers or members? It's just how we treat people in society. It doesn't matter whether it's a member or a member of the public. No one should be rude to our staff or to each other. It's as simple as that. And I think it's disgusting.
It's just people now, after this COVID thing, seem to have got worse.
Mm. Yeah.
Then you're driving down the road or whatever, you just be
attacked. That's fair enough then. Let's move on. Okay, so that's dealt with item 7A, and it's now nearly 5:30. So he was going to escape. Now,
rush him out.
Yep. Who's dealing with the next one? Robert's going to ask. Robert's in charge of the finance. Right, you might come to the table, Mr. Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right, because we're moving on to 7B, and this report is about fees and charges. Okay. Fees and charges for 2021.
Mr. Chairman.
We're halfway through. Right, it's up to you.
Obviously, the new fees and charges, we're working through them at the moment. They'll come to full council, and they'll be implemented from the 1st of January 2022. As the convention is, that we only report now on fees and charges which have gone up more than the rate of inflation, and that's been determined at 3%. And obviously, we have to look at rounding as well. So if something goes up 3.1%, then that will be included. We also report on any fees and charges which are removed and any new fees and charges. So in this report, you will see that there are two fees and charges which fall out of that convention. The first is for a new area in Market Square where we'll be introducing a charge. And that area is the area in front of the Santander Bank and Leeds Bank. So not the Market Square, but Market Square, then you've got the highway area, then you've got an area of land which we'll be introducing a charge for. The second one is for the removal of a charge, because it's an erroneous charge, because we charge for a marquee as a whole rather than a store. So it's been a duplicate which we've not used in the past, therefore we're removing the confusing charge.
Right, fair enough, we'll come back to that in a moment then. Right. Are you on a page or general, Mark?
Well, on what's just been said, because it's basically the report.
Okay, so go on then. Short
yeah,
term.
First of all, I was shocked that the farmer's market was being sort of deleted, but I'm glad that it's only taken the charge on a single water. The second one really is the land in front of Santander. Used to be a burger van there.
It was back. It was back yesterday.
Right.
And a florist.
It was. We were told at a previous scrutiny meeting that person had bought basically the rights to that pitch. Is that correct? It's the first question. The second question is: are we going to be careful with the work that we're proposing to do in the town centre to make it attractive to the many, that we get the right sort of tenants there?
Okay, so down to the first bit first. We have always given consents to a number of businesses. They're consents, not licences, which means that we consent those people to be there. And if we remove the consent, then they're not allowed to trade from there. In the past, we have given consents for an ice cream vehicle, a burger van, a florist, and also a baked potato person.
Yep.
Obviously, over a period of time, the baked potato person has gone, and we've not issued any further consents. The florist has gone, again, we've not issued a consent. The ice cream van now appears between April and the end of September, and we haven't seen the burger van for a considerable amount of time, so it's interesting that he's actually back, so we'll be in contact with that person. Now, for the consent, obviously there is a fee that needs to be paid, and that's laid out in the fees and charges, and that fee will be increasing by a rate at 3% forward. So we can, they haven't bought a right, it's a consent, we can actually stop those consents at any time. So as a part of the new development and the upgrading of the Market Square, we will be looking to see whether we wish to issue consents for that.
Thank you.
Right. We've got Gareth, the question, and then Dee.
All I wanted to ask was, what does £112.27 refer to?
Right, so for that money, that means that somebody can actually hire that area for the payment of that fee.
For a year?
No, for an occasion.
For one stop?
For one day, yeah. So that's what they would actually have to pay if they wanted to use that area.
So if they were there for 200 days a year, it would be 200 times £112.
That's right.
Right. I've got Dee and then I've got Brian Cross.
Yeah, it's in relation to the fees and charges. I'm obviously quite new to this committee and to the council, and it's very difficult to compare and contrast with only what you've added on and taken away. So can you make it easier for us to have a contrast? Because I don't know what last year's fees were, you know, and the public don't know what last year's fees are. So would it make or a link to last year, so I can
find it. Mr. Chairman, the existing fees and charges are displayed on the council's website, so you can access them from that site. The convention and obviously the constitution says that we only report on those fees and charges which go above that 3% you all removed. So that's why there isn't any further detail within the report.
So
although it might be helpful, it's not required. As I say, you know, what's also interesting is that I can say to you that there's been no increase in fees and charges for 2022 for land charges, car parking, or market rents, actually being frozen at the 2000 this year's level. But the majority of them have gone up by about 3%.
I think what the councillor's mentioning, and bear in mind that this is a new councillor, is that in actual fact, the paper copy of fees and charges, it was always interesting to read through, even if it wasn't something to do with your committee. Like, for example, the fees now being charged for the cemetery and things like that. Always very interesting to read. So, I will say this to the members of the committee. It was a conversation I had with Andrew Bailey about it. I had the same conversation a few before we started them, because I want to see a hard copy.
Yeah. So generally, obviously, Chairman, the fees and charges can still be viewed for this year. The new ones will actually go on the website. And the reason why we are discontinuing generally the paper one is obviously there's been a massive conference up in Scotland regarding climate change. And one of the things we've been looking to do is reduce the amount of paper produced. And as we looked at the document for fees and charges, it was probably nearly an inch thick. So that's why it was discontinued. But obviously, in exceptional cases, where there's a request from an elected member, without naming and shaming them, we could probably produce a document for them.
I have to smile whenever you give me an answer like that. Right, okay, I got D, now Brian Cross wants to talk.
Just follow up on Charlie's
Chris.
Outside centre. What happens when we have something like Walton Street or the Christmas event or the switching the lights on, etc.? And there's a big bandstand there. Is that charged? Or
so it all depends who's looking to come in. Obviously, if it's an event that's been put on by the Borough Council or it's one of its partners, then there isn't a charge because that would just be an administrative. It would cost more than actually the charge. So the council has got the ability to waive the charge for various events. But generally, that is the commercial rate. So somebody wants to come in commercially to do something. For example, I'm going to give you an example. Say a fun fair wanted to come in, then they would be charged that rate.
Thank you, Chairman.
Okay, then, so Chris Barron.
Thank you, Chairman. It's just a brief question for Rob, really. You mentioned the upgrade of the Market Square. Now, I'm talking about the upgrade, the rest of it, not our, the rest of it. Can you tell me when it's going to start, please? Because I keep being asked.
Can I pass that to Michelle?
And I will stay silent. So the Market Square form part of the future High Street fund bid. We didn't carve off the bit that was managed or owned by the borough and the bit that's managed or owned by the county council. We looked at the Market Square because that's how everybody else sees it. It is one space. So when we talk about refurbing that, we're talking about the whole Market Square. So this isn't the most exciting answer, but we're just coming to the end of the procurement process for the design and build works of that refurb. So we will have a contractor appointed before Christmas, and we will be looking at them starting work on their detailed design work very quickly, hopefully just before Christmas, possibly just after, and then the programme of works after that.
That'll be lovely, because I've got an old lady who keeps nagging, but she's right to that, she keeps walking, looking down all the time.
And of course, the thing is, she won't have the knocking of the paving slabs to keep her awake, will she?
That's right.
It's quite an interesting experience to walk across the Market Square because it goes knock,
yeah.
Knock, miss, knock. especially if you're especially if you're pushing a wheelchair across it as well. Okay, now I'm going to call the pages because we've gone on to talk about various things and we're not mentioning the pages. So this is 7B, page 7, anything? Over the page is page 8. Page 9 is the community impact. And over the page is the heading of fees and charges, the appendix. And there's no number on the bottom of that. We've talked about the new charge for the area in front of Lloyd's Bank and the telephone boxes. All right, you never mentioned that. And now we move on to page 12, corporate business partnerships, and this is the economic development section of the partnerships. Right, and who is dealing with that?
I think if you...
You're Red, Tracy Redknapper as well?
Oh, yeah, I'm now going to talk to Tracy Redknapper, that's okay.
Okay, fair enough.
If you wanted to do your normal page by page, that's fine.
Yeah.
As we go through.
Okay, do page by page. Right, okay, page 12. Page 12. D.
Thank you. I'd just like to say, actually, on behalf of the Labour Group, that how much we support the Stafford Station gateway project as we did with the development of Victoria Park, and grateful thanks for all the hard work that the officers have put in and bringing the projects together and actually getting obtaining the funding. Thank you very much.
And for those who may not have seen it because it's dark outside, if you look at 3-4, most of that building is down. And it's been an interesting situation driving into the building whilst that was being demolished. I don't know how the staff managed, but I know I came up the bus lane on one occasion with the thought, is it still operating? I'm about to be charged.
Yeah, I did exactly the same thing.
Yeah. And I got a message the next couple of days from the press office saying, you can't use it anymore. So that's that bit is done. Right, page 13. Anybody? Page 13. Sorry?
5.5. Who's received the grants?
So it's an enormous list of businesses. I sometimes flippantly say we're on about version 27 of the grants, but there have been an extraordinary number of different strands that Councillor Beattie's been involved in agreeing, basically the amount that we put into each pot and which sector we go to. We can give you, we can't tell you individually who all the businesses are, because we just won't be able to do that. What we can say is that we've made sure during the last 18 months that we've highlighted across all of the different sectors. So at the moment we've got a focus on retail, hospitality and leisure, because for all the reasons you'll have seen in the news, they're still struggling. But we've also focused on rural businesses, on self-employed. We've had a specific grant aimed at taxi drivers. There were some mandatory grants that were based on whether the government restrictions said businesses had to close, whereas we had other discretionary grants where some businesses didn't fit into some of the criteria that have been set for the mandatory grants, but we knew they were still struggling as a result of COVID, so we've been able to make some discretionary awards based on individual circumstances. So without kind of going into the specifics of the businesses, I think it's fair to say that we've covered the broadest spectrum that we could do and continue to do. So the money that we have is intended to last currently until the end of March 2022. What we do is take a view that if we think the amount we've allocated to a particular sector, there's going to be some left over, we then work up a new scheme. So if for example, there then becomes a particular issue with a particular area of business, we'll then focus the efforts there. So it's constantly moving.
So how are they advertised? Sorry, Chair, how are they advertised?
Okay, so we have a number of different ways of doing so, all kind of spearheaded by our comms manager, so Will Conhan. So he he basically makes sure that all of the different platforms that the council have, so we have our website, so there's a fantastic stat, I wish I could remember it, the number of people that were making visits to the business support page of our website pre-COVID was very, very small, went into the sort of tens, hundreds of thousands of visits, so that's the main area to catch it. Everything is then also shared on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We have corporate Instagram, not Instagram, LinkedIn. We have a corporate LinkedIn page that we then use to share that message. And then all of our partners then, I think you call it resharing on LinkedIn, they then share it as well, so it goes across that network. And we also make sure internally, we have an internal communications group, we send out the messages that these different grants are on offer, and literally, if you know anyone, and this is an open offer, if you know a business that you think may be able to claim one of our grants, even if the answer is no, tell them to contact us, because we want to make sure that we're paying everybody that's in the actual role, we've got the money to do so.
Alright, thank you. Alright.
Jim, can I just add one other? It's quite interesting that we have been working with HS2 as well, because they have got huge numbers of jobs already to support the rail project, and they're not in the obvious areas just of engineering, construction and so on. It's everything from bed and breakfasts to sandwich suppliers, you name it, there's probably jobs out there, and we've been involved with sort of open events that they've run to help them to identify the businesses. As a result of COVID and before, we have a really, really strong portfolio of businesses in this borough, from the very small micro businesses right through to the very big players, and that's enormously useful to us, and it will be to them as well. They're doing a tremendous job in supporting the development of new businesses and existing ones.
Can I make a comment from the chair about this building? If people haven't walked along the riverside onto Greengate Street, you should have a look at the job centre. Because I was amazed when I found it was the job centre with all those individual interview points.
You wanted a job, Jack?
Well, I'm always looking for jobs at my age. Being young and interested, and I said, but I'm moving now. I've got a good job here at the moment. Moving now from page 13 over the page to 14. Anybody got any comments on that one? There's only one comment I will make, and if you read that through, if you haven't made your application now, you've missed it.
Yes.
Because it closed. Right, I'm going to call the next pages out by numbers, and if you've got something to say about any of the individual ones, you should stop me. Page 15. Marnie?
L2, can you just confirm I'm reading this right? I haven't got my glasses with me. The number of startups, 20. So we've actually reached our targets, is that what that's saying?
Yeah.
Mm. That's absolutely fantastic. I was looking at the figures about the business startup business grants,
yeah.
And I was wondering how many people had actually started up. So this is post-COVID?
Yes. So the link back to the business grants is a really important one. And I've got the information from the team that have been doing the self-employed grants. So we approved 27 startup grants to a total value of just shy of £136,000. And that's where you then see that then becomes businesses in units that trade in, that real entities. So yeah, that's absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you. Right, page 16. Anybody got any comments on there? No? Page 17. Is 17, is it, D?
Yes,
right.
1.3.7
in the commentary, it says, and it was to do with the Gypsy Traveller site,
yeah.
A site was identified but was sold by agreement. What do you mean?
So basically, there's someone in my team who basically scans all the auction sites and everywhere that might be advertising land for sale. And equally, if anyone becomes aware of anyone that might be suitable, let's know, because then we'll look into it. And then what sits behind that is we have a pro forma that basically says these are all the considerations we need to make sure are okay for a site to be suitable. So we've been doing this over and over and over, as members of Scrutiny will know, and it's really difficult to find a suitable site. We found one, it was going up for auction, the price was reasonable, it hit all the main criteria. We contacted the auction house and they said, sorry, it's been agreed for sale prior to auction. So we tried and said, would you accept an offer if we made one? But it had moved sufficiently quickly that the vendor wasn't prepared to go back to entertain another offer. But we did try and make a cheaper bid, even though one of the others had been accepted.
Right. Okay, Brian, Cross?
Yeah, just talking about Gypsy sites, I'm sure I saw in the weekly report that an application was given or was submitted.
A new one?
For a new Gypsy site.
Is it for?
No.
Is it no
subject? No, I just saw in the weekly applications that I thought, oh,
yeah.
We're always looking for new sites. And was that one of them, or is that just for one caravan or something like that? I didn't really look at it. But
I think it's, a smaller number. I mean, it won't be as many units as we need to be able to deliver. But yeah, I can have a look through and see how
many. No, it's just as a matter of interest when you mention Gypsy sites.
Which, I mean, we do get them occasionally. Obviously, you've seen there's been the odd one that's gone to planning committee that'll be for maybe one or two pitches. What we're looking for is something a bit bigger than that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Which is why it's difficult to find the land because of the amount that we need.
Thank you.
Right, Mark.
Yeah, page 17. It was really, again, something that I get asked on an almost daily basis about the South Western Access Road basically being finished. I think the 22nd it opens, if I remember rightly.
There's
ceremony on the 19th. But it's really with regard to the Stafford Gateway development, and as with these things, there's been talk about there's going to be an Asda there, and all the goodness knows what else. I see here that we're halfway through some sort of delivery on Stafford Gateway, with Tara Hollingsworth.
Yep.
Would it possibly be sensible to speak to local members and county councillors, because there's been zero coming from the borough and actually county as well, that seems to be sort of, there are problems with land ownership and what they're going to do with it as well.
So if I start with the gateway a bit first, and then I will come back to the Stafford Western Access Road, it's kind of a nice news story and people probably do want to recognise that. So as far as the station gateway is concerned, literally at the start of lockdown last March, we commissioned a huge raft of work to work up a detailed spatial master plan, and that basically took the whole of 2020. But we were really lucky, we didn't get caught by COVID. The designers were able to go and visit the site because it was outside. We had the technical work done, so that progressed exactly within programme. What we've then had to do this year is look at that document. So we had that around February, March time. And basically say, right, what do we do with this next? How do we get it from being a master plan on a page to a delivered site? And that's where you start talking about land assembly and you talk about which uses go where and how that all fits together. To do that, both the borough and the county needed some more budget to be able to carry out, because there's technical work that sits behind it. It'd be a lot easier and quicker and cheaper if there wasn't, but we can't do it without it. So I think in July, I took a report through Cabinet and we were awarded an additional revenue budget to continue that work. The County Council did an identical piece of work through their Cabinet process in September. So basically, I think it was pretty much straight after that, 25th of September or something like that,
the project board reconvened to then say, right, these are now the pieces of work we need to do to be able to get to the point where we can put in planning application. So the next tranche of work, so we've got there a date of February 2022. That's specifically relating to the planning element of this. We are looking through 2022 by the end of the year to then be at a point where we can do a planning application for the whole site. In terms of communication with members, effectively, we were waiting until all of those different approvals were in place because it'd be quite difficult going to the County Council if you hadn't gone through your cabinet process. So, literally, now we've got that, a conversation we're picking up in the next couple of weeks with the two communications teams is how do we then take forward that communication? So it's members on both sides, but it's also residence groups, of which there are a number. There are a few on the sort of Newport Road, Castlefield side. There's a few within Doxey. So it's basically just working up the comms plan for that, so it won't be too much longer before you get that detail. Just on the South Western Access route, obviously the Borough Council did make a financial contribution towards that as well.
£2 million.
£2.5 million, as well as the contributions from the County Council, the Local Enterprise Partnership, and also the Burley Fields Development. So it's a huge, huge bit of infrastructure. The majority of the work has been done through COVID, and I think overall they've only lost something like 2 months. And this last little bit of delay has been purely because of an issue in getting hold of the safety barriers that go at the side of the road, which has now been resolved and it's ready to open. I think you said the 19th was the ceremony, the ribbon cutting. But if you think about that in the context of everything we've gone through over the last 18 months, to only have lost 2 months in the delivery of that road is phenomenal.
Yeah, just very quickly, Chair, on that, thanks, we've got to go to residents as well for putting up with the noise. While most people were sat in the garden through lockdown, people in Buxby were listening to the rhythmic sound of piles being driven.
As were those in Castlefields.
Yeah.
Right. You're mentioning there that money for the Western Distributor Road and the bridge. Did we get any money from the owners of the retail park?
Which was that for, sorry?
The old hospital site.
Yeah, as I understand it, it's £2.5 million from the Borough Council, £15 million as part of the Section 106 agreement for the Burley Fields development, and then the balance, I can't do backwards maths, sorry, but the balance was split half and half between the County Council and the Local Enterprise Partnership, as I understand it.
Correct. So
there was nothing from that. I don't think so.
Sorry, Chair, the Madford one, basically, the Madford site is owned by one operator, and it was actually the tenants who got any benefit from it, actually got benefit from it rather than giving money towards it.
Well, I know that the developer of that site was supposed to pay for a bridge.
Yeah.
They were supposed to pay for a bridge because it happened a long time ago. When you can have a look at the date when my name is on the board, when that was developed, they were supposed to pay for a bridge.
Perhaps,
Jason. All right. So I was interested to find out whether they contributed anything. But for those who don't use that area, there are now traffic lights at the junction,
which
make it a queue to come out of the retail part, and you queue there, and you're also they're queuing on the other side as coming down the road, so it's quite an interesting situation. Right, I got it's gone again. Councillor Phillips. Marnie.
Go on, Martin.
Thank you, Jim. Frustrating news about the delivery of the new Gypsy and Traveller site, but I have to say that as a whole, it's a good news page. I'm really proud of the work that's been done by the Conservative administration and our officers, who've obviously been working really, really hard to deliver and support delivery of these projects on this page. And I'm pleased to see that they're still on track.
Is this a political? Is it political?
Not
is it?
At all. I'm saying well done, and the performance
is obviously still showing that these are on track to deliver all of these, particularly supported the development of the Meesbrook Garden Community Project, which is something that I'm really excited about, where are we really in unity with this project, given that we've had COVID and we were so far ahead, weren't we? Obviously, we've hit a bit of a brick wall on this year.
No, not really. So, again, in terms of procuring the various technical studies that we needed to do, we didn't have any issues with that. I think we had one study where we had to go out twice for procurement, but that's because it was a very specialised piece of work. But other than that, everything has been moving according to plan. And there's a report heading for Cabinet next week, I think, which talks about the local plan timetable. And basically, what Meesbrook's sort of main aim this calendar year was to keep pace with the local plan, and it has.
That's fantastic. So they haven't done that one.
They're still on track.
Yes, I see they're on track. I saw the words on track, yes.
Yeah, so
okay. We're on to page 18 then. Anybody got any comments on page 18? Mark?
Just a quick one. First of all, I'd like to say what a fantastic job Martine's doing in trying to get business going in the borough. She's really someone we need to look after, because she's really sort of quite keen. But I wanted in particular to 141, the development of software is a hub of productivity to help businesses develop, grow and thrive. What's happening with the Shire Hall and the skills hub, which was supposed to be in the Shire Hall? What stage are we at with that?
Chairman, can I look straight back at Mark Winnington and say, what's the County Council doing about that? it's entirely in the gift of the County Council.
Yeah, I just wondered if it was.
We haven't had a planning application in or anything, as far as I know. We have had one in.
So basically, there was a planning application put in. So basically, the Shire Hall Business Hub, which is basically put at the back of the Shire Hall, so where the old library was, that got funding from the Get Building Funding, I think it's called, Getting Building Fund, and that had a spend deadline of potentially March of next year. It was a really quick deadline. So the planning application came in earlier this year. That was dealt with. No issues there. There was also a list of building application. That's all been sorted. As far as I'm aware, they've got contractors appointed to do the works. So it's purely a case of delivering it now.
Is there any proposed completion date?
I think it's tied to the spending of funding, because it's in. As far as I was aware, unless it's been extended, that got to be spent by the end of March.
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, right. Okay, maybe some of the county our local county councillors should, you know, mutter at the other place across the wall.
Occasionally, you have to ask questions in other places to find out what's really.
Thank you. Oh, it just shows you. Marnie again.
I just 1.3.9. I just wanted to say thanks to Michelle Smith, who also works incredibly hard, and we're really pleased to have you. Compliance of individual project plans, ongoing and on track. We're not foreseeing any hiccups or anything.
So with the really big projects, so if I talk about Future High Streets funds, so the bits that we've got control over, so running the procurement exercises, all the partnership work we're doing around that is all running completely to plan. The bit I can't plan for is whether we will have any issues when we start looking at materials and things like that, the issues nationally, potentially globally with the supply chain, the bits that are within our control, and that goes for all of the projects, so it's High Street, it's Gateway, it's Meesbrook, it's even down to the Stone Leisure project. Mm-hmm. The bits we can control, we're controlling, we just have to be mindful that there are those things going on that we can't control.
Can I come back on that?
Yeah, go on.
So I'm assuming then we're going to have to be incredibly careful about how we plan to rip up the flooring and the market and whether we've got the... It is something with a
Southwark University, who was unable to move into his university accommodation for 6 months because of building materials.
Yeah.
It is something that I'm quite conscious about, and I would hate to see us with an unlaid market flooring for the town centre and any of those nightmare scenarios that potentially may happen.
Well, we've been looking at the procurements. You can see the suppliers will say to us, these are the things we also need to think about, but we wouldn't have necessarily had to think about 12 months ago. So the programmes that we design against all of these projects, they're getting a more frequent scrutiny to make sure that what's going on outside of our control is reflected back in the way that we're planning to do the works.
Okay, so can I just quickly come back? So I'm assuming then that we will be having a way of notifying the public to let them know that these things are happening.
Yes.
They just might be delays in some, and it's nothing to do with us.
Okay, thank you. Still on page 18. Anybody else with any comments and questions? Right. We move down to 19. It's Alex. Alex isn't here, so.
Alex.
Yeah, you're Alex as well. Fair enough then. Mark? Don't get too excited. She might ask for a ride. Right. Mark, it's all yours.
Right. 152, embed high quality design into planning policy and the rest of that paragraph, ensuring staff is an attractive place to live in, promoting healthy lifestyles and supporting future investment. Can I possibly suggest that, in view of, I think the chair mentioned it, COP26 and what's happening in terms of the environment to go forwards and net zero, that there is some sort of mention in within one of the key deliverables around that. I think it's important that we don't just do the blah, 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 we actually do the...
Can you enlighten us? Because one or two of us are sitting here wondering what you're on about.
One thing that I went to a conference last week about tree planting, and there's a lot of... talk about sustainable tree planting and making sure that on the peri-urban areas, the edges of conurbations, that there is trees planted that people can walk into and they aren't going to rip the pavements up and everything else. So really, I think we're at a point now where the local plans are coming forward. It's the ideal time to look at some of the green planting, the trees, the green areas, as part of any future developments.
It's not for me to say, but I know somebody in the room might want to say. Francis, do you want to answer that bit?
Jim, I absolutely agree with all of that. I'm working with Alex very closely on all those issues in terms of the local plan. Another one is actually the requirements that we're going to make on new built houses, as well as retrospective fitting and so on, but for new properties, we're really hoping that the National Model Design Guide will insist on what they call smart housing now, which is that it's environmentally friendly, that it's energy efficient, and incorporates green features throughout everything from the way they manage water, water runoff, to the heating of the properties and what you build them with. Because you actually don't necessarily need to continue to build houses the way we have built them. There's a massive job there, though, because it's in the interests of volume developers to build the way they build. They have a model, and it's very easy for them to roll that model out and continue to do so. And it needs massive pressure from central government, and it needs massive pressure from ourselves at local government and individual level to say we're not having it, we want better, because some of the design, landscaping and nature recovery input into our housing units is not good enough. It really isn't good enough, and we're certainly going to incorporate that into the local plan. Please scrutinise it as carefully as you can, and we
see if we can get a local plan that is really fit for the 21st century.
Right. D.
I'm going to say that I was going to, that was what I was going to ask about, because it, you know, it's so important. It's not our future, is it? It's mine, it's my grandchildren's, and they're, you know, what are we doing to insist that houses are built sustainably and are built with the appropriate economic and eco things that need to be done? I'm no expert, but follow it very closely.
And of course, Chairman, we've got a huge opportunity with Nisbrook as well, because we are designing a whole new community, which will be an environmentally friendly site. I mean, it is an eco village, basically. That's been built.
Right. Okay, I'm moving on to page 20, which shows you the variance there from budget. All right, any questions? No? Moving on to page 21.
We've already raised the issue.
Yeah, we have, yeah. Mm. All right. Over the page to Annex 1, which is page 22. And you can see the comments on the right-hand side. All right, net. Agency costs are that mentioned there, reduced planning income, right? Local plan expenditure, and if you didn't know, the local plan went through the cabinet, and it's interesting to read, you know, the document from the cabinet. Right, page 22, that is. Any questions or comments? Page 23. And D on page
23. 22, I've had a number of inquiries because my members of my ward either run or work in the market, and we're also, it's about what's happening, like the co-op, the Guildhall, and the market itself. They want to know because the people are not going in because I think it's closed. I know there's been some work done because I've seen the boards and everything when I've been in town, but they're still asking me because they're really concerned.
So I'll let Robert update on the market if there is anything to update. But in terms of the Guildhall Centre, essentially somebody in the private sector has bought it, and obviously you can see that they have lost units within there because they've got plans for the site of their own. In time it will come into the public domain what it is they want to do with that site. What we do know is that any retailers that are still within the Guildhall but are looking to relocate within the town centre, Mark mentioned Martine earlier, Martine and her team will help any of those businesses, or indeed any other businesses looking for premises in the town centre, to help them to locate something that suits them. But I think we just need to wait a little bit longer to see what it is the owners of that site, you know, what their plan is for that. Unfortunately, it's one of these things where somebody buys something and you need to know straight away what's going to happen, but there's lots of stuff that has to happen in the background until they can be certain. So I think they're just going through that process now.
Mm. Yeah, I know. I've had numerous calls. Oh, yeah, probably a small amount, and I'm sure you're the same.
Right. Who's going to answer that question? Robert?
Market, right. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Following the last meeting, there was an excellent item in the Stafford newsletter about the future, you know, of the market in the next few months. Obviously, we're supporting traders as much as possible. We're looking for new market traders to come into the market. There has been issues with footfall into there, but the market manager and assistant is doing everything possible to keep the market as vibrant as possible. And as you've noted, we're not increasing market rents as fees and charges in the fees and charges from the 1st of January. So we are supporting traders over this difficult period.
Right, Chris Barron.
Right,
we'll start with the market. People haven't actually been going in the market for years. The footfall has been, looked good because they go through and straight out the array in the Guildhall Centre. So that's what's been happening. And because the Guildhall Centre now hasn't got many shops in, you're not getting that footfall so much. But people have been using the market for years and years. So it isn't a new thing. I can say that, yes, I did speak to Michelle some considerable time ago when the Guildhall Centre was first taken over the company, and was reassured then that they would help any trader that needed help in relocating from the Guildhall Centre. They would help them. And as far as I'm aware, they have them. So I would like to say thank you for doing that, because without that, you know, I don't think we've still got a shoe shop now. It is important that we do help these people to relocate. I just, like everybody else, want to know what the good ones are.
Marnie.
Thank you. I would like to say, we've lost some of the, let's say, more reasonably priced shops that were in Guildhall and some of the pound shops, etc., in the area. I would like to hope that people are going to support the market more, because it seems to me that with some of these shops moving in, it's reduced the trade within the market, because people have been using either the one-stop shops or they've been doing all their shopping in a supermarket. And it would be nice to see a little bit more positivity around our market with the work that's done around there, the independent stores, particularly some of these ones that really stepped up during COVID and helped with delivering food to some of our residents. But there seems to be this negativity. Anything that we do, when people are talking about Stafford Town Centre, there's got to be a negative spin. Market, there's got to be a negative spin. I think social media, I think people voicing their concerns, we need to be looking at this from a positive perspective now. Stop with the negativity. People are not going to shop in these places if everybody's telling everybody there's no reason to go there. And the reality is, there is every reason to go there, just as there was every reason to go there before. There's even more now. And I think that we need to be encouraging our residents to come and shop in the market, support these local businesses who are working really hard to earn a living, to support themselves and their families, and stop coming, stop listening to so much negativity surrounding it all. We need to stop this now.
I
support the hard work that, again, our officers and the market traders have done during the last couple of years to help everybody open. Thank you. Rant over.
There is an important bit to mention about the jail gate end of the town. Now, Specsavers has moved into the old Woolworths. What was the Woolworths when I first arrived here, which is next to the Guildhall, and that end, I walked through that end a couple of days ago, and there are lots and lots of problems at that end. One, for example, the co-op building. I mean, there was talk earlier about somebody being interested in that. That seemed to have gone very quiet. Centrepiece, built in the 1930s, the co-op department store. It used to have Debenhams in there, and one of our old councillors couldn't understand it was a cooperative shop because Debenhams was in there. True. D has got a question now.
It's more of a comment, if you. I'd like to actually say thank you very much for the hard work that your staff have done. I mean, the farmers' market is really growing, and the effort that they put in to support market traders and to bring in traders needs acknowledging, because I know how hard they work.
Right. Right, thank you for that. and Michelle, pass on to those that you are representing. Okay. We move on to page 24. We haven't got to 25 yet. 24. And of course there, for the cabinet member, the Pearlbrook Path is still there.
Still waiting to be
done.
To be done, yes.
Yes. Aye. Okay then, so that's the end of that particular...
So the whole of the area will become, if you like, a green space, to use the jargon, as nature reserve. The Pearlbrook Path then becomes quite important because it is a pathway right through the whole of that nature site. So let's hope that something happens.
Can I just ask, Chairman, does that include then? Will that include then? See if it's the new.
Goes up to Fairway.
Can I just stop you there a minute? This was brought up on a planning meeting, wasn't it? About the Spittlebrook. Right, it was brought up on a planning meeting. And right. Somebody
get you an answer on that.
Yeah. Andy Hart wants to say something.
Basically it's about the gypsy site, the funding for that. That 150,000 has been there for the last 10 years. Don't you think development sites have gone from twice again? Should we be putting a bit more money into it? I don't think you've been buying much for 150,000.
Don't argue with the staff. Let the staff say their piece.
So based on the site that I talked about earlier, then that budget would have been sufficient to secure that site and look to put services in. So yes, it is a realistic budget.
Right. Okay then, someone else put their hand up, wanted to say something. Marnie?
I just wanted to say the GC development regarding the Spittlebrook and the Corbett, they're looking at that being open, and that's going to be a heavy water overflow sort of stream through their sands, so that will be a running brook.
They're looking at making it into an
open stream through their site for any runoff of heavy water through thunder downpours, etc.
Can we make sure that the press are
treated as heavy water?
Heavy water.
It's definitely not heavy water.
Right, come on, we must finish this before 8:30.
Yeah.
I'm going to move on to page 25, which is our works programme. Our work programme, remember this is your part of this committee. I'll draw your attention onto page 26, 5.1. That this is owned by all members of this committee, and Andrew, you now talk us through it.
Yes, not too much to add, Mr. Chairman. On page 28 is the work programme in second appendix, and we do have scheduled another meeting before Christmas on the 14th of December, where the items there are listed should be considered.
Right.
Bear in mind that we've got Chairman for two meetings now at the development control, whether we ought to just have a brief update as to progress in terms of establishment, etc.
To have an update then, put that in, Andrew.
Yeah, we should do.
For the December, right?
But it's an important area.
So
please.
So we can judge by the next report,
see what progress has been made.
Right. Okay, then. And you see what's on the December meeting, 14th of December, 6:30.
Christmas
party,
is it, Jack, with you?
I've just twigged on. There's a chairman on another committee who brings in this very expensive wine, etc., but I'm not saying who it is.
We'll be happy with beer.
Beer. Okay. All right, so I better mark that up. Cost. Right, and you can see what is in on the February one. High Street and the market update. We should be hearing about that. And of course, future items. And I'm still interested. I know somebody is still interested in the Section 106 agreement.
Yeah.
He's not here at the moment, but he's very interested in that. So I do feel that, you know, we should be talking about that maybe in the December or February meeting. All right, then. Is that it? Any other comments?
Thank you
for your time, and thank Michelle for coming.